in which she said the weekend was a bust. Whether that was a transparent lie or not, it certainly lifted my spirits. I remember, like, re-falling in love when I got the letter saying that her weekend with the blind date was a disaster. The guy from Dartmouth was a, quote, animal, unquote, which was what we all kidded everyone from Dartmouth about being. I remember Thanksgiving of that freshman year. Colette was not going to come down, which seemed strange, and she told me that it was because of funds. She didn't have the funds to come down. And I remember thinking how weird that was, with Freddie and Mildred living in such, you know, supposed splendor in Greenwich Village. And I know this sounds ridiculous and self-serving, but it's not. I sent her something like $30 or $40 for her bus ticket down to New York. Now, I know it sounds ridiculous, but I remember writing to her and sending her either, like, two $20 bills or a $40 check, and told her, don't be absurd, you know, come down for Thanksgiving. It would be very lonely for you to be up there at Skidmore. And I remember her calling me and thanking me, and then she invited me in. Now, I wasn't there the whole weekend. I don't remember exactly how long, but I stayed overnight at the apartment in Greenwich Village on Washington Square, and the things that I remember most were two things. One was the walk through the village, because it was one of those beautiful fall days, and we were holding hands, and we were very much in love, and we stopped at an outdoor cafe, and we went through the park at the end of Fifth Avenue and watched the organ grinders and the people at the time when there were a lot of guitar players. And we thought, you know, that Greenwich Village was super, that it was neat and artsy-craftsy, et cetera, et cetera. And we had a very, like, lovely day. I also remember that night, the nice dinner we had at Freddie's and Mildred's apartment. Mildred was a good cook, and the dinners were always a little more formal than I was used to at my house. My house was very casual. At Mildred's, you know, everyone sat in certain places, and you stood behind a chair until the table was all ready to go, and then we all sat down, and certain ceremony was always performed with the wine, and it was much more formal. We kind of enjoyed it. Colette and I were learning from it, and it seemed very chic. Although we used to occasionally make light of it and think that Freddie and Mildred were blowhards about it, that they were a little pretentious. But the other thing I remember about that night is when Mildred and Freddie went to bed, Colette and I sat up. I was sleeping on the couch in the living room. It was a long, I believe, green couch, which they'd had for a long time. It was a very expensive couch. Colette had set up the bed, you know, set up the sheet and the pillowcases and the pillow and blanket and stuff. And we were sitting out there talking, and we began kissing and making out, as it were. And Colette got a little flustered and said that she really shouldn't be doing this at home. She didn't want Freddie walking out or Mildred walking out. And, you know, I said, fine. And she went to bed. And I remember it was very strange because this was a little atypical of Colette. She came out about 20 minutes later and lay down on the couch with me very quietly and a little apprehensively. And we began kissing and caressing each other. We ended up making love, and I remember it was one of those exquisite times where we were trying to be so incredibly quiet, and it was one of those times that Colette, it was sort of the excitement of doing something, I guess, that we shouldn't have been doing, and in a place where we shouldn't have been doing it, and the threat of Mildred and Freddie walking out at any moment, but it was more exciting than even usual, and she was sort of like giving herself to me by coming out of her room and getting into bed with me, and it was the first time that this had ever really happened because we had just recently begun making love, and it was a incredible, very exciting session. We talked about this for years afterwards, in fact, as one of our most memorable lovemaking sessions. We never openly discussed whether she or I had slept with anyone else. She always avoided the subject of Penny Wells. She was not really jealous of Penny. She always felt, like, unthreatened by her, but she didn't see any need to discuss it. I think she wondered what the attraction was between Penny and I, but we never talked about it. I never told her that we'd had a tremendous physical thing going, and, you know, we never discussed it. We sort of avoided those topics. We did talk about her feelings for Dean, never about potential lovemaking with Dean. I'm not sure if she made love with Dean Chamberlain or not. My strong impression is that she didn't. She always implied that in conversation. We never talked. I never said to her, were you a virgin? I never said to her, did you ever make love to Dean Chamberlain? It always seemed like sort of a too jealous thing to ask and too immature. And we always tried to respect each other more than that. She never, for instance, said to me, "Did you make love with Penny Wells?" I think we tried to be honest with each other, and so we skirted that type of question. We did make love in some wild places, though. I remember one Saturday morning, I was up seeing her. As a matter of fact, I believe it was Happy Pappy weekend at Skidmore, and Freddy Kassab did not go up. I went up. I believe this episode was Happy Pappy weekend. I may be incorrect. Happy Pappy weekend possibly was during the winter. But in any case, on Saturday morning, it may have been a later weekend in the spring because it was warm, she took me out to the Saratoga racetrack. They were either not running or the horses were running later in the day, but there were workouts going on at the track. In other words, there were grooms working on horses, and I remember there were, probably 50 or 100 people wandering around the stands, and there were people cleaning up. There were people mowing the lawn and doing the hedges and stuff like that, so the horses must have been in session. And Colette and I were walking in the infield, carrying a blanket, and I believe lunch, and we ended up making love under the blanket in broad daylight, very slowly and gently. We thought, of course, being very secretive and no one could possibly see us, that I'm sure anyone who passed within 200 yards of us could see that we were making love. And I remember that summer, one night we went down to a park in Patchogue. We were watching a big football game. I was playing on some softball leagues, and Colette used to love to come and watch me play. But this was not one of my games. This was like an A-League game. These guys eventually went to the Jones Beach World Tournament. But we went down to watch and got bored around the third or fourth inning, and we walked out into the outfield behind the fence, and we eventually ended up making love under our blanket while the game was going on, just out of the arc lights, just at the fringe of the lights. And I remember thinking what an adventure it was, and Colette felt the same way, that here we were making love only 400 feet from this whole crowd of people watching this big softball game.
Chapter 5. The laboratory team from Fort Gordon spent 4 days inside 544 Castle Drive. In addition to the 81 blue threads in the master bedroom, they found 19 in the bedroom of Kimberly McDonald, the majority of them under the covers that had been tucked up around the dead girl. 2 threads were found in Kristen's bedroom, but in the living room, where Jeffrey McDonald had said his pajama top had been torn during his struggle with the intruders, no fibers from it were found. A CID agent with a magnifying glass spent hours on his hands and knees searching through the nap of the living room carpet, but all he found was some confetti from a child's game and a few strands of tinsel which had fallen weeks earlier from the family Christmas tree. Investigators found not only fibers, but splinters. These splinters, which were bloodstained and which appeared to have broken off the club that had been found outside the back door, were located in all 3 bedrooms of the apartment, including Kristen's, although Kristen had not been attacked with the club. No splinters, however, were found in the living room, where Jeffrey McDonald said the intruders had struck him. There was, of course, a great deal of blood in all 3 bedrooms. In the master bedroom, in addition to that which had soaked the carpet, sheet, and bedspread, several drops of blood, forming a circle about 6 inches in diameter, were found just inside the room, near the doorway that led to the hall. There were also spatters of blood on the walls, and 1 more blood-streaked indentation on the ceiling, a mark which suggested to investigators that a club from which blood had already been dripping had been raised high above the head of whoever had wielded it, in preparation for the striking of a particularly forceful blow. A similar indentation was found on the ceiling of Kimberly's bedroom, and spatters of blood were found high on the wall above her bed. Additional, larger drops of blood formed a trail in the hallway between her room and the master bedroom. Across the hall, in Kristen's bedroom, there were blood spatters on the wall above the bed, blood in large quantity on the top sheet, blood stains on the side of the bed, and a large, heavy stain on the floor next to the bed. This, of course, was in addition to the bloody footprint, which led away from her bed toward the doorway. Blood was also found elsewhere in the apartment. There were traces on the door to a hall closet that contained a large stock of medicinal supplies, such as prescription drugs, syringes, hypodermic needles, and disposable scalpel blades. Several drops, as Ivory had noted, had dripped onto the right side of the sink in the hall bathroom, and, as Ivory had also noted, 5 drops, each about the size of a dime, had dripped onto the kitchen floor, beneath the sink, directly in front of a cabinet. When Ivory got down on his hands and knees and opened the cabinet door, he found, in the extreme left rear corner, tucked away behind a can of Ajax, a sack of potatoes, some scrubbing brushes, and a pile of old rags, an unopened box which contained several packages of Perry Pure Latex disposable surgeon's gloves. There were certain places, however, where blood was not found. No blood was found, for instance, nor were any fingerprints, on either of the 2 telephones that Jeffrey McDonald had said he'd used to call for help after checking the blood-drenched members of his family for signs of life and attempting to resuscitate them. No blood was found on the floor of the hallway where McDonald had said he'd lain face down and unconscious after having already been stabbed in the chest. And with 2 small exceptions, no blood was found anywhere in the living room where McDonald had said he'd been attacked. The 2 exceptions were the speck on the outer lens of the eyeglasses, which were identified as belonging to McDonald, and a bloody smear, having roughly the configuration of a fingertip, across the top of the March 1970 issue of Esquire magazine, the issue with Lee Marvin on the cover. Examination of the word pig on the headboard led technicians to conclude that it had been written by a right-handed person in full control of his motor faculties who had used the first 2 fingers of his right hand, those fingers encased in a thin covering such as a rubber surgical glove, and who had found it necessary to return to the source of the blood at least once in order to obtain sufficient quantity to enable him to complete the writing of the word. Jeffrey McDonald was right-handed. Examination of the blood on the kitchen floor, focusing on the extent to which it had splattered, led the CID to the conclusion that it had dripped from a height of between 20 and 30 inches, as it would have if someone bleeding from a small wound in the chest had crouched or knelt in front of the cabinet in order to remove something from inside it. William Ivory paid a return visit to Jeffrey McDonald's next-door neighbors. He asked again if they were certain they had heard nothing from 544 Castle Drive during the early morning hours of February 17th. The warrant officer's wife said no, she was not certain at all. She was, in fact, now certain that she had heard sounds coming from the apartment, but in the first shock of learning what had happened, she had been afraid to mention it. The way the apartments were laid out along Castle Drive, the neighbors actually lived above the McDonald's, although the entrances to the apartments were adjacent to one another. The master bedroom of the upstairs apartment was thus directly above the McDonald master bedroom. The warrant officer's wife now said she could remember having been awakened by the sound of Colette McDonald's loud and angry voice. She could not recall what words had been spoken, but she emphasized the anger in her voice. Her 16-year-old daughter also spoke again to Ivory. Her bedroom was directly above the McDonald living room. Often, in the past, she had been able to hear conversations from the apartment below, or the sound of a phonograph or television. Sometime after she had gone to bed on the night of Monday, February 16th, she said, she had been awakened by a sound from below. It had not been either the phonograph or television, nor had it been the sound of a struggle between Jeffrey McDonald and 4 intruders who were clubbing and stabbing him. She had heard nothing of the sort. What she had heard, she said, had been the sound of a male voice. It sounded to her like the voice of Jeffrey McDonald, either sobbing loudly or laughing hysterically. When asked at a press conference whether McDonald was considered a suspect in the murders of his family, the Fort Bragg Provost Marshal said, "There are a lot of suspects. Captain McDonald is certainly a witness."
The voice of Jeffrey McDonald. Interestingly enough, Colette and I do think that we know exactly when she got pregnant with Kimberly. It was sometime in late July or early August after sophomore year. I don't remember the exact date, but I remember the moment very clearly. We were at her Aunt Helen's, where Colette was staying for that summer. We had been spending every available moment, I mean every waking moment, together. I would stay over there until 11 or 12 or 1 every night and then go home. We were by now sleeping together fairly openly, but we were not, of course, taking precautions, except haphazardly, occasionally using condoms and occasionally using withdrawal and trying the rhythm method. But our lovemaking had increased greatly through the trips up to Skidmore and her trips down to Princeton and our vacations together and now the summertime, and our love was in full bloom. There was no question about it. We were already talking at this time of when we would be getting married, never from the viewpoint of, I never said to her, "Colette, will you marry me?" It was from the viewpoint of, "When do you think it would be possible for the two of us to really be together?" And it was always done in a sort of roundabout, mildly mysterious fashion. We never openly said to each other, "We're going to be married for the rest of our lives," but we talked in this kind of code about right after college it would be permanent and, isn't life fantastic now that we're together and seeing each other almost every day? But we were absolutely positive that Kimberly was conceived when we were making love one night about 11:30. Helen had gone to bed, and we were sitting in the car at Helen's house, and I was kissing Colette goodnight at the back door, and we kept kissing each other and kissing each other, and finally we moved over to the hammock, believe it or not, that was in the backyard, and we were in the hammock fooling around, kissing each other basically. And then we started petting, and gradually more and more clothes came off, and by now it was probably 12 or 12:30 at night, and we were in the hammock, and Colette was very gently saying, "No, you can't, we're not taking any precautions." And I was saying, we have to, I promise I'll pull out, as usual. And we were extremely passionate, passionately making love, and we sort of exploded and lay there in each other's arms, and we did something which for us was not that common. Normally we made love once, and occasionally, like especially on the honeymoon, I remember we made love many times in one day, but we did not have this need between us to make love two or three times a day. We usually made love once, or something like that. But I remember this specific night, we lay there, and 20 minutes later we were making love again. And we stayed there until about 1:30 or 2 in the morning in the hammock in each other's arms. And I remember neither of us felt any, guilt or negative feelings about this. We were totally in love at this point. We really were throwing ourselves at each other, and there was a feeling that both Colette and I had that it was just such an explosion that it had to have been that night that she got pregnant. Colette always said that she could tell. Anyway, it wasn't 2 weeks later that Colette came to me, kind of embarrassed and apologetic, and said she was 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 days late on her period and that she was going to have to go see the doctor. I told her at first that that was nonsense, and with more hope than fact, I told her that she was just missing her period because she was scared. And she, we were scared, there's no question about it. We didn't know what it meant for her schooling, for my schooling, our life. And yet there was this element of sudden excitement between us. I'm not saying we were proud of what we did. We went to my mother and father first and told them with much fear and trepidation, and were vastly relieved when they seemed to handle it so gracefully and gently. There wasn't even like a burst of anger. There was some sadness and resignation, but actually I remember being acutely surprised. At my father and mother handling so gently, talking to us that we had to make a decision, marriage number one, adoption number two, and abortion number three. We immediately, in our own minds, threw out adoption. We wrestled for a day or two with the thought of abortion, but we clearly were opposed to that. Colette and I were very much in love. Neither of us at the time really believed in abortion. Colette was much more anti it than I was. I wasn't pro or anti, I just had never thought about it. But when it was us facing it, it was an uncomfortable and an ugly thought. Neither of us liked it. Neither of us really wanted it. We struggled with it for several days, and we mutually came to that conclusion that we would not have an abortion, that we couldn't get an abortion, that we just couldn't face each other, and that we didn't want that, and we loved each other, and why shouldn't we just go ahead and get married? Freddie, on the other hand, and Mildred were very clear that the decision should be, number one, abortion. Their explanation, which was very open, was that the pregnancy and marriage at this time would hurt my career. They were worried about my medical career, and they stated it. But once we decided to get married, then Mildred made no bones about the fact that she wouldn't mind having a physician as a son-in-law. Our wedding day was a little bit overcast. We were afraid that it wasn't going to be a nice day, but it ended up being nice. It was a little windy, but it was September in New York, and it was beautiful. It was a little cool, too, as I remember. I don't think it ever really got hot that day, but I remember being in a nice breeze, and it was a beautiful day, and the wedding went off very, very smoothly, very beautifully. Everything was just super. It was a really nice wedding. We stayed that night at the Hotel Pierre up on Central Park South, had a nice room, and despite the fact that we had just left the reception, we decided to really show off and order from room service. So we ordered, I believe, like at 10 o'clock at night, steak sandwiches and champagne, and it was something like $60 or some incredible cost like that, and she and I both almost fell over. It was a very exciting time. We had a very lovely night. It was a funny night because we were tentative, despite the fact that we'd been sleeping together for at least a year and she was already pregnant. It seems a little silly, but in fact, we really were, it really was like a honeymoon night. We were very tentative, and I'd say gentle with each other. It was sort of the beginning of our real life together. The honeymoon was kind of a funny time. It was, I don't have one word to describe the honeymoon by any means. There was a certain amount of hesitancy. There was a little chagrin because Colette was pregnant. We had this sort of feeling of adventure, that we were embarking on this great life adventure together, and that somehow we always knew we would do that ever since we met in the eighth grade, and now we were fulfilling that. And yet you have to remember it was 1963, and it wasn't common for college kids, especially at Princeton, to have to get married all of a sudden and have a child. As a matter of fact, we had to ask permission to be married at Princeton at the time, so it was, you know, there was a whole host of confusing emotions. We drove up to Cape Cod, and the week is a little blurry, to be honest. I have some great remembrances of us walking together through, I guess it's Provincetown at the end of Cape Cod, and eating the saltwater taffy and going in all the shops. It was a quiet time, of course. It was after Labor Day, and it was so beautiful. We had two or three rainy days out of the week, and only two or three sunny days. But we enjoyed both. We were kind of oblivious to the weather, and we had a super time. We were arm in arm, and we would eat a late breakfast and a great big dinner and walk around and shop. I had been passed a lot of envelopes all through the reception. People kept, you know, coming up, wishing us congratulations and giving me envelopes like they do at Polish or Italian weddings. And when we got to this motel in Provincetown, we sat on the bed and we took out the suitcase. We had thrown all these envelopes and cards and everything without really looking at them the first night into the suitcase. And the next night, we're up in Cape Cod and we undid all these envelopes and we had almost $3,000 sitting in front of us, which at that time, in 1963, was an extraordinary sum of cash. I still remember this very clearly. We were sitting at the edge of the bed. I was, as a matter of fact, on the left side, sitting on the bed looking down toward the foot. And Colette was on the right side, and her back was a little to me as she was opening some of the letters, and my back was a little to her. We both turned and looked at each other after the first couple of letters, and she was squealing, sort of, with delight as she opened each letter, and I ended up letting her open the majority of them, because it was so much fun to watch her. And they kept making this mound of money and cash and checks, and, like I say, it ended up to right around $3,000, and we were just stunned. It was sort of hilarious. We didn't sort of know what to do with that much money, so we put it all in a big wad and put some rubber bands around it and put it back in the suitcase. But I remember we had a super week. One dinner we had was the best of the whole honeymoon. It was, I think, like about the second or third night. We found this Portuguese restaurant, which we went back to later in the week, which is always a mistake. You can't really recreate. We had a... The second dinner was nice also, but the first dinner was like magic. It was the first time we had... We ordered a strange wine. I believe it was a Portuguese wine, and we had a Portuguese dish, and I don't remember what it was, but I remember everything was spicy, and we tried everything with entrees and soup and the salad and then the main course, which was seafood. We both picked seafood, but they were done Portuguese style, and they were very zesty, spicy hot. We had the absolute most delightful evening. It's one of the best evenings I think we ever had. We laughed and giggled the whole time and had the bottle of champagne at least, and then we went back to the motel and had a super night. I think we realized then, it was about the third day of the honeymoon, although we had really no bad feelings, bad premonitions, we had hesitancy. And at that point, about the second or third day of the honeymoon, we felt that, sort of, we could conquer the world. That the union was so fine and so much fun and held so much promise and fulfillment for both of us.
Chapter 6. The bodies of Colette MacDonald and her two daughters were buried in a Long Island cemetery on Monday, February 23rd. Immediately afterward, Freddie and Mildred Kassab retreated to the seclusion of their home. They pulled down the blinds to shut out the light and have their phone number changed to prevent any incoming calls. In their grief, they wanted total isolation. Jeffrey MacDonald's mother did not have the time to plunge deeply into mourning. She left the gravesite and drove immediately to New Hope, Pennsylvania, to meet with a psychiatrist concerning difficulties being experienced by her older son, Jay. The previous November, in apparent reaction to a drug overdose, Jay, who was a year and a half older than Jeffrey and who, like Jeffrey, had been named most popular male during his senior year of high school, had suffered a schizophrenic break with reality. This had resulted in his arrest and confinement to a state mental hospital after he had assaulted his mother on a street corner. A police report prepared at the time said that Jay struck his mother several times about the body, and that it had been necessary for officers to physically subdue him. The incident had occurred on November 7th at the corner of Windsor Avenue and Montauk Highway in the town of Brightwaters, New York. Jay had been brought to a local precinct house and examined by a police psychiatrist who recommended transfer to Central Islip State Hospital. Jeff had been called home on emergency leave from Puerto Rico, where he had been on a training exercise with his Green Beret unit. Jay had been released from the hospital within a week and had returned to his part-time job as a bartender at a Greenwich Village tavern called The Shortstop. On the morning of February 17th, having been informed by Freddie Kassab that she was to accompany them on the urgent and ominous trip to Fort Bragg, Dorothy MacDonald had tried unsuccessfully to reach Jay by telephone. The next day, while at Fort Bragg, she learned that Jay, having heard the news of the murders on the radio, had suffered a relapse and had once again required hospitalization. A close family friend named Bob Stern, who was in the computer business and who had access to a private plane, had obtained Jay's release from the hospital in order that the two of them might fly to Fort Bragg to attend the funeral on February 21st. Afterward, Stern had flown back to New York with Jay and had helped him transfer his belongings from the Greenwich Village apartment he was sharing with a merchant seaman to the Stern home in New Hope, Pennsylvania, about 30 miles north of Philadelphia. Arrangements had been made for Jay to recuperate at the Stern residence while undergoing psychotherapy as an outpatient. Dorothy MacDonald was a sturdy, energetic woman of 50 who was employed as a school nurse. Since her husband's unexpected death of lung disease at the age of 48, 4 years earlier, she had noted a steady deterioration in her older son's emotional well-being. Since his November breakdown, she had devoted an enormous amount of time and energy to efforts to aid his recovery. Now she was faced with him in a state of relapse, and with her younger son, Jeffrey, recovering from injuries sustained during the assault, which had resulted in the murder of his wife and children. After visiting Jay and the Stern family, and meeting with a psychiatrist in nearby Doylestown, Jeffrey McDonald's mother drove back to Fort Bragg on Tuesday, February 28th, to return to his hospital bedside. Jeffrey McDonald remained in Womack Hospital for 9 days. He looked pale and said he felt exhausted. He complained of frequent, severe headaches and of an inability to sleep. An armed guard was stationed outside his door to protect him from any attempts at further violence by the four intruders who he said had massacred his family. The chest tube used to re-expand his lung did not function properly, and it became necessary to insert a second tube. He was seen twice by a Green Beret psychiatrist, a major with a shaved head and a handlebar mustache. "Normal grief process continues," the major noted at the conclusion of his second visit. On Thursday, February 26th, his lung having healed without further complication, McDonald was discharged from Womack Hospital and was assigned to a room in bachelor officers' quarters. The armed guard that had been stationed outside his hospital room was withdrawn. Upon hearing of this development, McDonald's mother confronted his commanding officer. She demanded to know why the guard had been removed, particularly since, in an unsupervised BOQ room, her son would be in more danger of an attack by murderous intruders than he had been while hospitalized. She was told that law enforcement officials at Fort Bragg did not feel that her son was in danger. "That makes it sound," Dorothy McDonald said, "like you suspect Jeff may be involved." The commanding officer assured her, without attempting to explain the contradiction, that her son was not considered a suspect. He said, in fact, that having just gone through such an ordeal, Captain McDonald was now free to take some time off, and added that Mrs. McDonald could retain her visitor's suite in order to remain close to her son as long as she wished. That evening, Jeffrey McDonald said he found his new room unbearably depressing. He said he could not yet cope with solitude. He spent the night on his mother's couch. McDonald, however, was indeed a suspect at that time. Even before his release from the hospital, military authorities, while continuing to refuse public comment, newspapers reported that a shroud of secrecy had enveloped the investigation, had concluded that the young captain was the primary suspect in the murders. In a report never publicly released, the Fort Bragg Provost Marshal expressed the opinion that the accuracy, similarity, and location of the wounds strongly indicates actions of one individual with expertise on vulnerability, killing as rapidly and mercifully as possible without creating any noise. He added the observation that all the knife wounds were deep and in a relatively small area of the bodies, and that there had been no disfiguring and no sexual molestation, indices which, to him, pointed away from drug-crazed hippies and toward the one man, husband, father, and physician with an interest in surgery, known to have been in the apartment at the time that the murders occurred. The provost marshal's opinion was shared by Franz Joseph Grebner and the two CID investigators, William Ivory and Robert Shaw, who were working most exhaustively at the crime scene. The three of them, within days, had come to believe it highly likely that Jeffrey McDonald had, for reasons unknown, killed his wife and children, and had then, in an attempt to escape detection, staged a scene designed to make the murders look like the work of drug-crazed intruders, even going so far as to puncture his own lung in the process. As early as Monday, February 23rd, the provost marshal had informed the FBI that they could cease their nationwide search for the four killer hippies. He said a preliminary consideration of the physical evidence did not indicate that any civilians had been involved in the commission of the crimes. Nonetheless, pending laboratory analysis, the evidence against McDonald was non-existent. Thus, at the beginning of March, when Dorothy MacDonald asked if she could take her son to the seashore for a few days of rest and recuperation, no one at Fort Bragg felt there was any basis for not granting her request. So, during the first week of March, Jeffrey MacDonald and his mother drove to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, for what she hoped would be a restorative time near the salt water to which she had always been attracted as a child. Later, MacDonald would recall that trip. "We drove down in my white Chevy, the white 65 Chevy convertible with the black top. It was a really nice car. It wasn't souped up or anything. It was a handsome convertible for the time. I'm sure I did the driving, because that would be my normal personality. And I can see us driving along this two-lane highway. It seemed to run indefinitely. It was almost an extraordinarily long 4-hour drive. We talked aimlessly about things, not seriously ever about Colette, Kim, Chrissy, or that night. We talked about other things, about Jay. I believe I knew at this time that Jay was having problems. I don't think I was aware of the depth of his problems. I knew there was something going on up north. In early March, however, the air was chilly, the sky dark, and many of the better motels and restaurants not yet open. We stayed at a motel which I would rate as 1 star out of 4 stars, possibly a half star instead of 1. The rooms were drafty, and it was a cold weekend on the beach. It was gray, overcast, windy, like 45 to 50 degrees, which was perfect for my mood. It was just how I felt. It was as though the cumulonimbus that were scudding across the skies were a reflection of me, rather than a clear sky that would draw me out of this depression we were in. We found the food to be sort of unpleasant. I don't remember anything that we ate, but I remember that we were displeased with A, the accommodations, and B, the food. We had a couple of crummy meals. The town was almost shut down because it was the off-season. We did walk on the beach, though. I remember my mother was frustrated and anxious because things were not turning out like she hoped. She had hoped it would be warm and sunny. I think she sensed what I've always known about myself, and what later years proved to be correct, that I do recover with the sun. I need the sun. Basking in the sun rejuvenates me physically and emotionally. A long, sunny weekend is the best possible cure for me. But that was not to be. My mother was trying to give me space, and yet she wanted the weekend at least to have something nice to try to lighten the load. So therefore, she was frustrated and anxious, and I was the one who had to turn and say to her, "Relax, that's okay. Just, we'll walk on the beach anyway." So we did. But actually, walking on the beach was not a good thing for me at that time. It was a melancholy thing. I'm not a beach walker. I'm a much more active person than that. So I was walking along and remembering both my father and my family and trying to forget the recent tragedy, and I had to keep turning from my mother so as to not let her see me cry, which is my way, right or wrong. As MacDonald's mother recalled it, "The time that we spent at the shore was very quiet. We would have a quiet breakfast, go to bed early, rest, and so forth. He complained of a headache, and I'd give him an aspirin, you know, just to reduce it. We picked up shells, and he just walked. He walked for hours along the beach. I did not question him. I never probed. I could not ask questions. I felt that other people had. I was the mother of a young man whose wife and children had been murdered, and my concern was to give solace and to try and help him bear this agonizing burden. When he wept, I was trying to tell him that it was really rough, and I understood, and that we would just have to go on from that point. And sometimes he would weep, and he would say, 'I love them so much, Mom. You know I love them so much.'" Back at Fort Bragg, on March 6th, Jeffrey MacDonald wrote a letter to the Kassabs. "Dear Fred and Mildred, apparently it was not just a bad dream. The magnitude of our loss is something I'm still trying to comprehend. I know this won't help you in your grief, but I want you to know that I loved Colette more than anything in the world. I know she was happy as long as we were together, and I will never be the same person without her. Although my family is gone, it helps me just a little to remember that Colette and Kim and Christy and I had as much happiness in our short years together as most families have in a lifetime. Colette truly loved you both and would want you to remember the happier times. Love, Jeff.
The voice of Jeffrey McDonald. The year at Princeton was incredibly great. I was in absolute love with Colette, and I thought having Kimberly was neat, and we had tons of people over to the house. We had just moved into a house on Bank Street, right off Nassau Street, across from the university, and we had some great times. The big dinner that Colette and I learned to cook for all our friends, mainly spaghetti, but we had some others, and our house became as I knew my house in Patchogue, where my parents were the entertainers of everyone. Colette and I had sort of taken over this role at Princeton. We were the hit of the campus, so to speak. Of course, that was the year that Bill Bradley became a big star, and the next year he went on to superstardom, but we were good friends with Cosmo Iacovazzi, who was the All-American football player at Princeton at the time, and I remember he used to come over to eat, and we had a blast together. I was so proud of Princeton and being a member of the Tiger Inn, the Eating Club. It wasn't Ivy or Cottage, which were the rich boys' clubs, but it was, you know, one of the top five for sure, and it was the jock club. Cosmo Iacovazzi was a member, and Colette was proud of me being in there. We had some difficult times. I remember there was a football weekend, and we had invited my parents, and we had tickets for the game and everything, but my father was always an enigma. You never really could figure out what was going to happen next. He was very ambivalent about a lot of things. He was proud of me being at Princeton, but he was also upset a little bit that it was maybe too snooty a place. In other words, it was too pseudo-intellectual, and it was perhaps a little bit left-leaning. And more importantly, it wasn't the working people. It was the phonies of the world that were going there. My father was essentially an unschooled person. He was extremely bright, a voracious reader, an intellectual at heart, but one who tried to hide his intellectual, both capabilities and desires, under a barrel. He would have liked the world to have believed that he was rough and tough and non-intellectual, in fact a laborer, and he would occasionally make what sounded like racist comments, either about racism or other religious groups like Presbyterian or Methodists or whatever. He was raised by his great-grandmother in Gardner, Massachusetts. His own mother had gotten married at 15, just like her mother had done, and just like her mother had to leave her behind to go off and find a way to earn a living, she had had to do the same thing when her husband left her. She moved to New York when my father was very young, leaving him with this great-grandmother who spoke French and who was apparently a very tough woman and very dominating. He became an electrical designer. He had gone to technical school, and essentially he was a draftsman. He worked at the Brookhaven National Laboratory, and even though he never finalized his engineering degree, he never really forgave the intellectually elite community for not recognizing him as an engineer. He always resented that he was being paid less to do full engineer's work just because he was a designer and did not have a degree. There's no question that he was the leader and ruler of our family. His presence, it's almost beyond comprehension how important he was to the family. His presence was huge. Wherever he was, in whatever setting he was in, he was a very magnetic person, not a shy person, a lot of charm and grace, always a gentleman and chivalrous. He treated women in a chivalrous fashion, which now, of course, would be considered chauvinistic, but his hold on the family, even to this day, is staggering. My dad was the family, and that's the truth. He was a phenomenal person with an incredible presence. I think no matter how strong my mom got, and this is a little unfair, but it's simply a fact from my viewpoint, no matter how strong my mom is and was, my dad was still the main mug. He was a dominating force in all of our lives. There's no question that he was the most important force in my brothers and sisters' psyches. My brother, incidentally, was clearly favored by my father, simply because he was firstborn, and, I suspect, also in mine. He was not a peaceful man, by any means. He terrified us when he was angry, and a mere look, or the thought of him being angry, would completely silence us and stop any problem. Also, he constantly railed against the domination by women that he saw in the world, and his background, of course, is very consistent with that. Never to his dying day did he forgive the women of this world for attempting to rule and take over, and many was the time, especially when he'd had a little too much to drink, I heard him say that a domineering woman was the most dangerous creature on God's earth. In keeping with that, he was not a warm, loving father. He was a little distant, especially physically. My father was super masculine, and he never really touched us or hugged us or kissed us, because that was unmanly. He could never express his love for us. We all knew it was there, but we never heard it spoken and never felt a physical embrace. What he demanded most were two things, absolute obedience and achievement. In my family, any indication that you couldn't keep up or couldn't be superior in every field or try harder and overcome whatever adversity it was a sign of weakness. And what I remember most clearly about him, I suppose, were the trips we would take on Sundays to visit my grandmother, his mother, in Malvern, where she had finally wound up living. It was a harrowing experience to go 45 miles along the old 1950s back roads between Patchogue and Malvern with an impatient, angry father driving the car, bitching constantly about the inadequacies of every other driver on the road. He was always very tense and angry on these trips, and he was extremely vituperative toward other drivers. His frequent expression was he wished he had a Sherman tank, or he wished he was driving a big cement truck and he could just squash the other cars. But anyway, at Princeton, we had this big weekend all set up, and one of the highlights of these weekends was bringing your parents to the club for dinner. And I remember that my father was already sick and having difficulty walking long distances, and the day was a trial for him because we had done so much and walked so much, and we had to walk from the club at lunchtime to go down to Palmer Stadium, which was a pretty good walk for him, being short of breath, and then walk back and have dinner. And I'll never forget how incensed he got that we had black waiters in little white short jackets serving us in the club. He became furious, and as a matter of fact, we got into an argument at the club over that, the particulars of which elude me, but I was embarrassed about his anger. The black help and the short white jackets were uncomfortable to him at best, and snobby and pseudo-intellectual and effete at worst, and we had a little sort of scene that day together, and I'm kind of sorry, of course, that it occurred. We didn't have that much time together from then on, and I remember with some sadness that this occurred. From time to time, I brought Colette to the club, the Tiger Inn, and she was funny. She was a little ambivalent. She didn't like the idea of clubs at Princeton because they seemed a little white glovish, too much like something Mildred would like. But she also kind of enjoyed the status, and also the fact that the Tiger Inn was considered a really good club, one of the top five for sure, and it was the jock club. And she was proud of me being in there. We went over and had lunch and dinner many times, especially on football weekends, and she was kind of proud of that. And there were no other relationships going on at all during this year. I wasn't seeing anyone or doing anything. I was coming home. You know, we had a good year. Kimmy's birth was, of course, traumatic, no question about it. Colette, you know, did not like pain. We had joked for a long time about natural childbirth, and she had even made a little pretense at beginning classes for natural childbirth, but she was advised not to by her physician and advised not to by me. I knew Colette very well, and I felt that as soon as the first pain came, the plans for natural childbirth would go out the window, and indeed they did. Colette is a feminine, gentle person. She was not a sturdy frontier woman. She was very motherly, especially later on, with two kids. She was an incredibly good mother. But at this point, you know, she was reasonably frail. Like, for instance, she's left-handed, you know, and so she had this funny-looking shot on the basketball court, and she could dribble only intermittently well, sometimes with both hands. But very feminine and pretty, and it's distressing to see her with the hair, you know, a little scraggly, and sweating, and grunting and complaining about the pain. So I'd hold her and talk her through it, and we were doing the breathing things, and she was very reassured that I was there. There's no question about that. I'm not just saying that. I really always have felt very strongly that she did trust me implicitly, and the fact that I was there holding her hand was very important to her. I did leave at one point for about an hour. It was something to do with canceling classes or something like that. I may have had to run over to a chemistry lab to hand in a paper or tell my lab partner that I wasn't going to be there or something like that, and came right back. But the doctor arrived shortly thereafter, checked her, and what happened was he examined her a couple of times, and he clearly had a frown on his face after the second or third examination. Then they took x-rays, and another OB man was there also, and it turned out the baby was too large for Colette's pelvis type, so basically the doctor and I told her together. We came in together and said, "It's not progressing well, and we think that we're probably going to have to do a cesarean section." The doctor and I then had a discussion about whether I would be in the cesarean section room. I didn't particularly want to, not because I was squeamish. I didn't see any reason to be there. And I always felt that it would sort of impede the doctor. I still believe that, to this day, by the way, about other couples when they ask me. But he was not at all in favor of me being in there, so as we mutually discussed it, it became clear that it was clearly better that I wasn't in there. So I sat outside the operating room in a little, you know, sort of waiting area, and read a Reader's Digest and a Look magazine, then reread the Look magazine and paced a little and had a cup of coffee and, I guess, the usual parent routine, new to me but not new to anyone else. Finally, you know, he came out from the operating room, seemed like an eternity, by the way, and said that everyone was fine and that we had a girl and that the baby was happy and healthy and Colette seemed to be doing fine. But she was exhausted from the long, sort of non-productive labor. I saw the baby. Oh, it wasn't immediately. It was more like a half an hour later, and the baby, quite honestly, to me, she did not look that pretty. Everyone kept saying what a pretty baby Kimmy was. She was cute, but she wasn't, you know, an elegant-looking baby. Anyway, she was healthy and appeared happy, and Colette was certainly healthy and seemed to do fine. But she was sort of knocked out from the surgery, and she was very wan in the recovery room, but happy that everything came out okay. Mildred had come to help out at the house, and she and I were hitting it off better at this time than ever before or since. We had a good time. We went to dinner together. I showed her around Princeton a little bit. She met our friends. She was staying at the house in one of the bedrooms. Didn't, of course, like the house. Felt it was, you know, not clean enough. Felt that it was not nearly up to the standards that her daughter should be kept in. But I handled myself well, you know, through all of this, and she liked that. I was clearly in charge of the family, and it was working out well for Colette. Anyway, our friends had a nice, joyous reaction. We did the pass-out-the-cigar routine, and all my friends stopped by. Cosmo Ikavatsi, who was the All-American football player, stopped by. He was a good friend at the time. We were in Tiger Inn together. And his wife, whose name I forget, who was a great cook. She cooked her spaghetti sauce, by the way, with the pork chops and chicken in the sauce, and then they scooped out the pork chop and chicken and didn't serve that, and just used sausage and meatballs left in the sauce for the meat. But the flavoring was with the pork chops and chicken. It was a great spaghetti sauce. It was a true, great, real Italian homemade spaghetti sauce, and it would take her a whole day, and she made it once a week. And she wasn't even really Italian. Cosmo Cavazzi's mother had to teach her how to cook that. She always recalled that as one of her traumatic events of getting married to Cosmo. Anyway, they came over, and we had planned this big thing for when Colette came home from the hospital, but she was very worn out. She'd lost some blood at surgery, and it took a little while to get her back on her feet, so she wanted it a little more quiet. 2 or 3 weeks later, though, we had all our friends over, and I cooked spaghetti one night. It was a positive time in our lives, and I remember sort of how proud it was to be, you know, a father.
Chapter 7. Freddie and Mildred Kassab visited the cemetery every day in March, bringing fresh flowers each time. Other than that, they went nowhere and spoke to no one. No one called, no one visited. Letters of sympathy piled up unanswered. Though neither she nor her husband felt the desire to eat, Mildred suddenly found herself with an inexplicable but irresistible compulsion to bake. She baked pies, cakes, cookies, and bread at all hours of the day and night. The aroma of her baking filled the air. Soon the refrigerator was full, then the freezer. Still, she baked, stacking loaves of bread on kitchen counters. Mildred seldom spoke to her husband. He very seldom spoke to her. There was, they both felt, nothing to say. Nothing would ever be worth saying again. Words would neither soothe nor heal, nor undo death. So the Kassabs existed, side by side, in a silent darkness beyond words. A shipment of clothing arrived from 544 Castle Drive, the contents of Colette's and the children's drawers and closets, items that had been deemed of no evidentiary importance. Mildred sat alone in her bedroom, sorting the clothes, suffering new stabs of agony every time she came across a little dress or coat she recognized. Worst of all was handling Colette's nursing bras and maternity girdles. The new baby would have been born in July. On routine errands, Mildred would see a pregnant woman and start to cry. She would see a bearded, long-haired hippie and feel an almost uncontrollable surge of hate. She could not understand why the killers had not yet been apprehended. Mildred was not a strong woman, physically, only 5'1" tall and very thin. But her grief and rage were immense. At Womack Hospital that first afternoon, she had said to Jeffrey MacDonald, "If I ever found her, the blonde in the floppy hat, I would tear out her eyes and her tongue and turn her loose." Her desire for vengeance was undiminished. It was the only feeling left to her, other than pain. Eventually, she had to stop her baking. The kitchen could no longer contain what she produced. Yet not a single piece of cake nor slice of bread was ever eaten. She and her husband were utterly without appetite. At the cemetery, she would whisper to Colette, "Help us. Help us." Then she and Freddie would return home. At 17, Mildred Kassab had married a man 10 years older than she was. His name was Cole Stevenson, and he had owned a luncheonette in downtown Patchogue, an undistinguished working-class town on the south shore of Long Island, physically quite near but socially worlds removed from such fashionable resort communities as the Hamptons and Amagansett. Mildred had wanted a baby right away, a girl whom she could dress up in fine and fancy clothes. When she became pregnant, she and her husband transformed one room of their small rented house into a nursery. They pasted silver stars on a pale blue ceiling and nursery rhyme characters on peach pastel walls. They painted yellow and white ducks on the floor. In a closet, they hung a little fur coat and a row of tiny, frilly dresses. Mildred decided that if the baby were female, she would name it Colette, after its father. The baby was female, but stillborn. That had been the first Colette. A second pregnancy resulted in another female infant, the second Colette, also stillborn. A year later, the third Colette was born. The baby died within weeks, however, following surgery to relieve an intestinal obstruction. Mildred did have a healthy male child, and then, 4 years later, on May 10, 1943, she gave birth to the fourth Colette, the one who would live, the one who would marry Jeffrey MacDonald. One Friday evening in the spring of 1955, Mildred was returning home from having picked up her son at a friend's house. As she opened the door to her garage, the car headlights illuminated the interior, and she could see her husband's bathrobe hanging from the rafters. In the same instant, she realized he was in it. Coles Stevenson had left no note. He had not seemed depressed. There had been no sudden trauma in their life. Mildred told friends she had no idea what had driven her husband to suicide. Colette, who was 12 at the time, had been spending the night at a friend's house. Her Aunt Helen had broken the news to her because Mildred could not bring herself to do so. Her father's death was the one thing, in later years, that Colette would never talk about, not to her mother, not to her friends, not to her eventual husband, Jeffrey MacDonald. When she met Freddie Kassab a year later, she told her mother right away that she hoped the two of them would marry, so that everything can be the way it used to be again. After the marriage, Colette began immediately to refer to Freddie as her father. Never did she call him her stepfather, nor would she permit her friends to do so. Mildred had arrived at the Princeton Medical Center in April of 1964, the day after Kimberly was born. Colette had been holding the baby at her breast when her mother had walked into the room. Looking up from her bed, Colette